You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, turning off your lights can save lives. That's the message from a Wisconsin environmental researcher who says energy conservation can have big benefits for public health. Now, Wisconsinites went to the polls yesterday to vote on a variety of local races and to choose the next justice on the state Supreme Court. It was another close election, with conservative-backed Judge Brian Hagedorn coming out about 6,000 votes ahead of Judge Lisa Neubauer, who had liberal support. Hagedorn declared victory this morning, but Neubauer has not officially conceded, and her campaign pledged to pursue a statewide recount. If Hagedorn's lead holds, it would ensure conservative control of the court until at least 2023. And for national observers, it's yet another sign that Wisconsin's one of the most competitive states heading into the next presidential election. Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter. Laurel, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, bring us up to date on the latest. Hopefully nothing I said is untrue as of the last 5 minutes.
You never know when that's going to happen. No, we haven't had any crazy breaking news in the past 5 minutes or so, but it is looking like that recount is going to happen. We know that both the Neubauer and Hagedorn campaigns are fundraising for that recount right now. Because the margin of victory, is about 0.5%, less than that 1% threshold required by state law, there can be a recount in this race, but the second place finisher would have to pay for it. So we know that recounts in the past, like the 2016 presidential recount, cost about $2 million. So these campaigns have quite a bit of fundraising to do if that is something that one of them ends up pursuing.
Now, that said, just shy of a 6,000 vote gap, based on what we've seen in past recounts, I mean, I'm not going to ask you to break down the algorithms and the math. It seems to me like a potentially tall order to have a recount overcome that big a margin.
That's right. So we have had a state Supreme Court race that flipped by that much of a margin in the days following an election. The Supreme Court race, I believe it was in 2011, had 12,000 votes show up the day after the election. So it's not unheard of to have something change in a big way. But in terms of recounts, you know, we do have that 2016 presidential recount we can point to, and the change there was really marginal, certainly not 6,000 votes when ballots were recounted.
What did turnout end up looking like yesterday?
Turnout was very strong. Turnout was the highest it has been for one of these spring primaries for quite a while. I believe the State Elections Commission just came out and said it was about 27%. And that was a big part of the conversation about, you know, how close these races are. We saw the bases for each of these candidates in Dane County and those so-called wow counties around Milwaukee really turning out in a big way for these two candidates.
And as far as flips, last year the liberal-backed candidate won fairly handily, but a couple of key counties in northeastern Wisconsin, Brown and Outagamie counties, including Green Bay and Appleton, looks like they really flipped to the other side this time around.
They did. So Rebecca Dallet flipped Brown, Winnebago, and Outagamie in 2018. And this year, Brian Hagedorn recaptured those counties. So, you know, it's a little bit of kind of a coming back there. We've seen that those counties have been more of a lean conservative sort of place in recent elections. So that was a little bit of a, you know, kind of a return from the flip in this race.
Talking to WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White about yesterday's state Supreme Court election. Judge Brian Hagedorn has a lead. A recount is likely, very likely, it looks like. National election watchers, Laurel, are watching Wisconsin closely. The message that I think they must be getting is don't try to predict the next Wisconsin election based on the last one.
Absolutely. You know, it was interesting, obviously, on election night, we spend a lot of time on Twitter, and one of the tweets that really, I think, resonated with a lot of folks last night was from the director of the Marquette University Law School poll, Charles Franklin, and he tweeted that this is probably going to be the new normal for Wisconsin, this sort of very, very close race where we see the results flipping back and forth over the course of minutes, just, you know, hundreds of votes separating candidates at certain points. We saw that with Governor Tony Evers and Scott Walker last year, and we were definitely seeing that last night. So Charles Franklin says this is something that Wisconsin voters and political watchers are going to have to get used to. because Wisconsin is certainly kind of living up to its bona fides as that swing state.
Now, talk a little more, getting back to the Supreme Court itself, talk a little more, if Brian Hagedorn's victory holds, what does this mean for the court?
So that would change the ideological balance of the court. It's currently 4-3 in favor of conservatives. That would give conservatives a 5-2 majority. And this is particularly important because liberals had their eye on this election as a way to set up getting the first majority on the court in several years during next year's state Supreme Court election. So Justice Daniel Kelly, who was appointed by Governor Scott Walker, is up for election next year. It's during a presidential election. Those races tend to see strong turnout for liberal candidates. So liberals kind of had their eye on it, on that race in particular, as a way to get another liberal-backed justice on the Supreme Court. Now, if they had gotten Neubauer in this race, that would have allowed them to take the majority next year. But if Hagedorn does end up victorious in this race, that would just get them back to the 4-3 balance. So really, this was kind of, this wasn't the deciding factor for sort of tilting the balance of the court, but it was a necessary step that liberals needed to take to put that in motion.
Now, I know people will be dissecting what happened yesterday for a while. What kind of arguments are hearing from either or both sides on why the election went the way it at least appears to have done?
Mm-hmm. What I've been hearing from a lot of conservative pundits and commentators is that this was really a victory for grassroots conservative organizers across Wisconsin. As listeners are probably familiar, Hagedorn was operating with much less money and much less support than Neubauer throughout much of this race, didn't have as much advertising. He did get a pretty substantial bump in the last days of the race from the Republican State Leadership Committee. They came in with about a $1.2 million ad buy. But overall, that he was kind of outspent in this race. And so conservatives are saying that local organizing, people getting out on the ground, conservative talk radio that we talk a lot about in Wisconsin, really came through and helped push him to an outcome that not a lot of people were expecting. A lot of people thought that this was Neubauer's race to lose.
And I've seen some Democrats in Wisconsin around the country saying, yeah, Republicans are better at getting people motivated for this kind of maybe non-high-profile race than Democrats are. Is that something you're hearing here in the state?
Absolutely, particularly when it comes to Milwaukee County. So Milwaukee County really didn't show up in the way that they did for Rebecca Dallet last year for Judge Neubauer this year. They had an increase in turnout, but her margin of victory just wasn't enough. And so I think Democrats are talking about how to motivate more of those base voters in Milwaukee in these nonpartisan spring elections. We know that Milwaukee hasn't been particularly great for that in the past. We'll remember the 2016 presidential race. That's, you know, obviously not a nonpartisan spring race, but Milwaukee kind of lagged there for candidate Hillary Clinton. So I think as we head into 2020, people are going to be certainly very focused on turning out the strong numbers the Democrats need from Milwaukee.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, with us to break down the results of last night's election for a seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Coming up, turning off lights when they aren't needed can actually have significant health benefits. We'll find out why coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new research out of UW-Madison shows how turning off lights during high energy use times can help save lives. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a questionable cuisine.
We recently received listener questions from Joe and Racine and Mark in Madison. They wanted to know, what's the deal with cannibal sandwiches? Why do people eat them in southeast Wisconsin? WPR's Mary-Kate McCoy went to meet with a couple cannibal sandwich aficionados to find out more.
Imagine, it's the holidays, and to quiet your pre-dinner hunger, someone hands you a slice of rye bread topped with a thick spread of fresh raw beef, chopped onion, and a sprinkle of salt and pepper. Sounds great, right?
At first you look at it like, excuse me? We're supposed to do what with that?
That was Jeff Zupan, operations manager of Bunzel's Meat Market in Milwaukee and a lifelong cannibal sandwich enthusiast.
Hello, Bunzel's. Yeah.
Around Christmas time, Bunzel's goes through over 1,000 pounds of raw beef and about 250 pounds of raw onions, exclusively for cannibal sandwiches. While southeastern Wisconsinites may be the more eager cannibal sandwich consumers, they've been spotted across the upper Midwest. Chef Justin Carlisle of Arden in Milwaukee remembers them from growing up on his family farm in Sparta, which he described as an initially terrifying ordeal. But Carlisle has since come around. He even serves a dish at Arden that was inspired by cannibal sandwiches.
We have beef tartare, and it comes up from me growing up with cannibal sandwiches and me being the youngest of three boys and completely terrified of this raw beef sitting on the counter when I was a child. So I would go along and never want to get made fun of, so I would take the ground beef and put it on my grandmother's deviled eggs and then eat it really fast.
This is the part of the story where I have to tell you, if you're going to prepare a cannibal sandwich, do so with precaution. And to help me is a doctor who may be a familiar voice to public radio listeners.
I am Zorba Pastor, and I do like cannibal sandwiches. But the problem is, of course, there is a risk with eating cannibal sandwiches. The best cannibal sandwich with the lowest risk is if you take steak or something like steak and you grind it up. The worst cannibal sandwich is if you simply eat ground beef out of a package, because then the risk of E. coli is greater.
Zorba says to let your butcher know you're using the meat for cannibal sandwiches. Ask for it to be freshly ground with a clean grinder.
All good.
So where did cannibal sandwiches come from? Their history in Wisconsin is a little murky, but Chef Carlisle says their story is likely one of practicality and tradition, going back to the Northern Europeans who settled in the state.
Especially being an extremely agricultural state, it is one of the necessities that you always had. You know, it's kind of like making cheese in Wisconsin, like you always had dairy and you always had meat.
Despite their history, the sandwich's popularity has plummeted. But at the butcher shop, Carlisle and Zupan talk about how they're seeing signs of a cannibal sandwich comeback.
I think that maybe we have a little ways to go before it becomes a staple back again.
In the Midwest, it's been always here. It's just sort of undercovers.
Like, everybody knows what it is, but nobody ever talks
nobody
about
wants
it.
To, nobody wants to call them cannibal sandwiches.
Right.
The old-timers do.
Right.
They come in and go, I want some of the meat for cannibal sandwiches.
Right.
The other people are, I'd like a steak tartare, or I'd like this or
right.
that.
Maybe when we get old enough to not care anymore, then yeah. we can do that,
we
too.
We can say whatever we want.
Right.
Carlisle and Zupan say one thing is for certain. Here in Wisconsin, the food culture is much more than burgers and fries.
A lot of the foods and a lot of the ways people prepared things and did things were lost for so many years. And everybody wants to blame it on the millennials, but it was long before that where it died off. And people, like I say now, are like, oh, gee, I remember when Grandma made this. And how'd you do it?
I'm very proud of our area, but there are things like the cannibal sandwiches, and now to have this come back, to me it means a lot, because otherwise we just become a commodity and the United States doesn't get any kind of differential of what areas and what immigrants and what styles were in each part of the United States and what history was there.
The story was by WPR's Mary-Kate McCoy and came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, many a parent has been driven crazy by kids leaving the lights on all over the house. The usual argument, that's costing us money on the utility bill. But a new argument might be turning off the lights could save lives. A team of researchers at UW-Madison used several different models to measure the impact that energy conservation can have on human health. Tracy Holloway is the Gaylord Nelson Distinguished Professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. She was the senior author of the study. Tracy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I know a lot of the work you do is about connecting the dots. Connect these dots for us. We turn off the lights in our house, we save some energy, we conserve, and it helps human health. Why?
Yeah, so it's not a surprise that when you save electricity in your home or in businesses, that there's fewer electrons that have to flow through the wires, and that's because the power plants don't have to work as hard. And power plants are a major source of air pollution, including carbon dioxide that's affecting global climate, but also pollutants that directly impact human health. These include nitrogen oxides and sulfur dioxide, which cook up in the atmosphere to form fine particles and near-surface ozone. And both of those are associated with a wide range of health impacts, including premature deaths. So one of the thoughts that we were trying to calculate is, how would a pretty modest energy efficiency scenario, a what-if question, and in our case we looked at 12% energy efficiency, what would that mean in terms of lives saved and also in terms of avoiding the worst air pollution days across the United States?
Yeah, before we get into some of the numbers, those worst air pollution days, I've talked to you about this a little bit before, they're often in the summer, right?
Absolutely.
What are the differences? Why is that in the summer? Why are things worse then?
Yeah, so ozone is a chemical that we hear about in different ways. So sometimes we say it's good up high because up in the stratosphere, it protects us from incoming radiation, but it's bad at the surface. Sometimes I use the metaphor that, you know, just like sunblock is really good for keeping sun's radiations away, we don't want to drink it, and we also don't want to be breathing in ozone at the surface of the Earth.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, but this ozone, it cooks up, and what it needs is sunlight and warm temperatures. So here in Wisconsin, those are really a summertime issue.
Now, you used a few different models to try to figure out what conservation would mean for human health, for mortality rates among people, among other things. What kind of things did you do to try to tease out that connection?
Yeah, well, first there's the question of what power plants would be turning off or on or cranking down a little bit to if we're trying to save energy. And this is a question isn't that easy, because if you're in a particular city in Wisconsin, even if there's a power plant nearby, that power plant may or may not be providing your electricity. So when you save electricity, it's affecting power plants all across the eastern United States here in Wisconsin. In the western U.S., it's similarly connected. So the first model we used was trying to move from the actions across the United States to the specific power plants that would be affected by energy savings. Once we know which power plants are turning on and off, we can know what chemicals are being released into the atmosphere at different rates, and then what's cooking up. Because we want to know if a power plant in Ohio is turning on and off, that's going to have a different impact than a power plant in Wisconsin or in Massachusetts.
What kind of difference did you see energy conservation making when it came to saving lives?
Yeah, we found that across the United States, we found lives saved from avoided particulate matter and avoided ground-level ozone. And in a state like Wisconsin, those numbers are between 2 and 5 lives saved per year. In bigger states with bigger populations, you see bigger impacts. But keep in mind, these aren't huge numbers, but we also looked at a very modest energy efficiency scenario. So one of the ways we tried to compare apples to apples is to look at the dollar value of those lives saved using a standard value from the Environmental Protection Agency of about $8 million in value per death avoided. And so when you run the numbers in terms of the value of the lives that you're saving from reducing a kilowatt hour of electricity, we calculated about 5 cents in health benefits per kilowatt hour saved. And a kilowatt hour costs about 10 cents. So really, each time you save electricity, you're saving money in your pocketbook, but you're also having a measurable savings in terms of the health benefits spread across the whole U.S. population.
What kind of changes would look like that level of energy conservation cuts in someone's house, in someone's workplace? What kind of difference would we feel?
Yeah. A typical home uses about 900 kilowatt hours per month. So talking about the equivalent of a little bit more than a day's worth of your home electricity, or 10 hours of TV time, for example, might save 1 kilowatt hour. And that would translate into about 5 cents of savings on somebody's life. So 5 cents is much less than a whole life, of course. But one of the things is that, you know, there's so many people using electricity through so many different formats that it tells us that this is a mechanism where people can save money, we can reduce carbon emissions, we can make our air cleaner, and we can improve life expectancy. And that's a pretty good win-win.
And part of what you're trying to do, as I understand it, is that you know, there are people researching energy conservation over here and people studying air pollution over there, mm-hmm. and they don't always get together and share their findings. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. For air pollution, we've made huge benefits over the last few decades. Air is getting cleaner and cleaner because of very effective pollution controls. But those pollution controls are only targeting specific chemicals. And one of the things we're trying to say is, are there more win-win opportunities? Ways to save money, to be moving into a clean energy future, to be reducing carbon emissions, and to be achieving these health and clean air benefits. So over the past few years, we've looked at solar energy, we've looked at building energy use, but this study with energy efficiency is one of the most exciting scenarios because there's no downside. Saving energy saves everything: money, carbon, air pollution, and lives.
Do you see energy efficiency as kind of a low-hanging fruit in our overall energy picture?
Absolutely. It's one of these things that is invisible. We don't really see how much energy we're using when we choose to buy a refrigerator. All we want is something that keeps our food cold. We don't care if it is, you know, using more or less electricity. But there's a lot of technology improvements to make refrigerators more energy efficient and air conditioners more energy efficient. But it also comes in the way that we're building our buildings. If you have trees near your building and there's shade, you don't have to crank the air conditioner as much. If you have sunlight coming into an office building, you don't have to use as many light bulbs. So there's a lot of solutions that are things that people would want to do anyway, and trying to figure out how can we count those benefits to meet our air quality goals and achieve other environmental benefits.
Tracy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Tracy Holloway, professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. She joined us to talk about new research that shows that reducing our energy consumption can help save hundreds of lives across the nation each year. Coming up after the news, we're often told that we'll all be happier and healthier after enjoying a made-from-scratch dinner. But is that goal a reality for most Americans? We'll hear why home cooking might not be the solution to all of our problems. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show, Wisconsin has the frozen tundra. We have cheese. Put them together and what do you get? Frozen pizza. Find out why Wisconsin is a leader in the world of frozen pizza and be careful on that first bite. You don't want that cheese burn. That's tomorrow morning at 6:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, gathering as a family around the table for a home-cooked meal is often held up as a remedy to many of our problems. We're often told that a made-from-scratch dinner is our ticket to health and happiness, but is it really as simple as that? Our next guests say the home cooking push often puts intense pressure on families, especially women, and doesn't confront the real inequalities in our food system. Sarah Bowen and Jocelyn Brenton join us now. Sarah is an associate professor of sociology at North Carolina State University. Jocelyn is an assistant professor of sociology at Ithaca College. They're two of the three authors of the new book, Pressure Cooker, Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems and What We Can Do About It. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
And Jocelyn, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Rob.
Well, Sarah, you write in the book that now, maybe more than ever, we have food as this matter of national concern, pop cultural concern. We keep hearing these stories, make our own food, make things from scratch. How much pressure is there for us to make this home-cooked meal?
Yeah, I think we've seen a ramping up of pressure. People look around and, you know, they see problems in the food system. They have concerns about food safety and lots of contradictory information about health and nutrition. And then that is combined with some kind of anxieties about what parents are doing and how children are growing up. And all of that kind of comes together in this ideas about family meals and this idea that if we can make good dinners from scratch with especially, you know, fresh produce, and we can gather around the table and happily eat it together, that we can help make sure that we raise happy children and be happy families and good parents. And it's a lot. It's a lot that has to come together to make that happen.
Yeah, Jocelyn, I think a running theme in this book for many people across the United States, you focus on a particular area, easier said than done. Talk about what you did, you and your colleagues, to try to get at the stories of the challenges people face in trying to get this kind of meal on the table.
Sure. So this study began back in 2012, and we thought to ourselves, okay, so if we really want to know what's happening and sort of what people are facing when it comes to getting a meal on the table, then you really need to talk to the people who are doing the feeding work, and that's mothers. So what we did is we set out and we conducted in-depth interviews with 120 mothers. Some of them were grandmothers and caregivers. These women were middle-class women, but also most of them were low-income women. And we asked them, what is your day-to-day like for you? What sort of meals do you put on the table? And also, what do you think is an ideal meal? What does that look like to you? So those answers really form the majority of the book. And we also said, okay, we know what people are telling us when we talk to them, but we also want to see what they're doing in their everyday lives. And so we followed 12 families over time. We would go and visit them, you know, a dozen times over the course of a month. And we'd tag along at the grocery store, and we'd sit with them around their tables while they were eating, so we could actually see for ourselves what families are trying to do when it comes to getting a meal on the table.
And Sarah, we'll get into some of the particular challenges and obstacles they face, the people that you followed and talked to. But in general, was there anxiety for a lot of the people, even across income levels?
Yeah, what we found was that cooking and food was really important to almost all of the mothers in our study. And it was actually, it was 124 poor and working class mothers, but then even more than Jocelyn said, so it was over 150 moms. And so that was a lot of women, and food was really important to all of them. They were all trying really hard, you know, sometimes in slightly different ways, but almost all of them also felt like they were just not measuring up in at least some way, that they were failing on a regular basis, and that cooking and the time around dinner was stressful. And Ann Meyer, who's a sociologist at Minnesota, she told us just in a conversation we had at a conference that she's done time use studies, and the period from 5 to 7 p.m., if you look at how parents feel about their days, is actually the lowest point for parents. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just the moms in these studies, but this is a bigger problem of parents feeling really stressed about dinner, and especially mothers.
We're talking to Sarah Bowen and Jocelyn Brenton about their new book, Pressure Cooker, Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems and What We Can Do About It. Jocelyn, let's look at some of the challenges now that these women were encountering trying to make this meal, this evening meal, as often as they could. One of them you encounter with a lot of the families, just the affordability of the food. They wanted better stuff. They couldn't necessarily afford it. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So one of the things we find is that these mothers care deeply about their children, and they all have an idea of what good nutrition is, and everybody sort of knows what that involves. The question is, do you have enough money to buy the foods that you need? And so a lot of the mothers in our study were having some real difficulties. Employment was difficult to find. Some mothers were employed only part-time. Some weren't able to secure employment at all. And so money was an incredibly big issue. Many of them said, oh yeah, I would love to buy organic foods if only I had that kind of money. And it wasn't just the low-income families. It was also the middle-class families. And this was somewhat of a surprise. We tend to think of the middle class as people who are getting their basic needs met and doing okay. But even these families said, I would like to buy more organic foods. I'd like to shop locally or at the farmer's market. But there's no way that we can do that all the time. We just simply can't afford to do that.
And Sarah, it wasn't necessarily just about being able to afford the food, but being able to afford facilities to cook it in. I know at least one of the families you talked to, maybe more, had gone through eviction. They were trying to prepare these meals in a inexpensive hotel room. Can you talk about the kind of challenges you saw there?
Yeah, one of the 12 families, so we organized the book around nine families' stories, and one of those families had been evicted before, not when we did the interviews, but in between the interviews and when we went back to do the observations. So when we did the observations, we had the opportunity to see how hard it is to get dinner together when you're living in a hotel room, and actually how expensive it is. So Patricia Washington and her daughter and then her two grandchildren were all in a small, cramped hotel room, and so they had a microwave and a hot plate and a tiny fridge, and that was all they had. There was a grocery store across the street, so that helped a little bit, but It was still hard to go back and forth because they couldn't really stock up in big quantities, which made it hard to take advantages of sales. And she talked about that, how she would like to be able to stock up when things were cheap, but she couldn't. And then, of course, the problem that was even worse was that they were super limited in what they could buy. So they were buying a lot of TV dinners, some frozen pizzas, and kind of heatable soups. But those things are expensive compared to raw ingredients, so their food stamps weren't going as fast as they could. And, you know, they were really low on food. Sometimes Patricia and her daughter would skip meals so the kids would have something to eat. And we saw that in other families in our study because the moms felt like their most important job was making sure the kids had something to eat, but then they were going without themselves some of the time. So that was just really hard. And Patricia, we didn't have a lot of homeless families in our study, but more broadly, we did have a lot of families who lacked basic kitchen tools or who would have the electricity cut off or the stove wouldn't work. And so we really saw how sometimes this ideal that it's not really that hard to cook, it ignores the real problems that lots of families are facing.
Jocelyn, another challenge you encountered with families was difficult scheduling. If they had jobs, they might not have a reliable schedule. How big a factor was that in making it difficult to make regular meals?
Yeah, unpredictable work schedules was a huge factor for a lot of our families, and especially for the working class families who worked, for example, at fast food chains. They would get ready for their shift, and they might receive a call at the last minute that says, we don't need you, or they might be asked to work overtime. And also, they only learn about their schedules on a weekly or a biweekly basis. So this makes it very difficult to plan and be home for the family meal. And in addition to that, a lot of these families didn't have what many Americans take for granted, which is just a working vehicle. And so when you don't have a car and you can't get to your job and leave the house when you want to, we saw that a lot of the mothers we got to know, they were relying on a vast network of family and friends to give them rides to places. And they would all sort of, you know, share resources and work together. But if somebody's ride falls through that day, it just sort of throws the rest of your day into chaos. So it made getting to work difficult, and then the actual nature of having an unpredictable work schedule made it very challenging for these families to sort of create that ideal meal scenario in which everybody's gathered around the table at 5:30 or 6 p.m. and they're all having a conversation about how their day went.
We're talking right now with sociologist Sarah Bowen and Jocelyn Brenton. They're two of the co-authors of the new book, Pressure Cooker, Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems and What We Can Do About It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do these stories sound familiar to you now or at some point in your life? Do you feel a lot of pressure to deliver perfect home-cooked meals for your family? What kind of obstacles are there for you, whether it's being able to afford the food, having your work schedule line up with dinners, having the family's various activity schedules line up, and do you feel guilt and or anxiety about the food you end up serving? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, coming up some possible solutions to these challenges. That's up next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Sarah Bowen and Jocelyn Brenton. They're professors of sociology and co-authors of the new book, Pressure Cooker, Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems and What We Can Do About It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you hear this message a lot, that home cooking is the solution to a lot of our problems? Are you able to do this? Do you find it stressful, difficult to pull off sometimes, all the time? Why? And do you feel pressure, maybe stress, or even shame about what you end up being able to serve your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn, we've just got into a few of the challenges, but I want to get into some of the solutions you talk about. A lot of times it's presented as individually, we have to fix this. You and your co-authors, Jocelyn, see this as a wider problem and that needs bigger solutions. What are some of those?
In the book, we talk about how we can be working at three different levels. We can be working at the national level, we can be working at the community level, and we can be working at the individual level. And this is problems with our food system, problems with population health. These are bigger issues that we have. It's not just a matter that parents aren't making the right choices for their children. And to the extent that parents have limited choice or aren't feeding the kids the way they want, it's because there's some bigger problems going on around them. So, for example, at the national level, we say that we really need to invest in our families. If we value families and we want our nation to be healthier, then we're going to have to change some of our policies. And that starts with making food a basic human right. And there are other ways in which we make other things basic human rights in our society, like education or the right to representation. And food is so essential to our health and well-being and our daily functioning. So we think that we should make food a basic human right, and we can do that by expanding some of the safety nets that we have for people, and the food stamps program is one of that. And we could also look at what it would look like to better fund school lunch programs. And so those are, for example, some of the things that we can do at the national level. That we also just need to make sure people have a living wage and that families are supported with things like maternity and paternity leave and paid sick leave. These sorts of policies go a long way in supporting families and making sure they're healthy.
And Sarah, in the book, you also talk about, and Jocelyn just mentioned, community-level solutions. You found in some different places innovative ways where people try to work together, use existing facilities to make it more possible for people to have meals. What kind of things did you see?
Yeah, so this project was a research project, but we also did a lot of community-based work in the three counties that we were working in. And so we saw that people are already doing things to support, and these should be expanded. One relatively simple thing is that a lot of the churches and nonprofits and community groups in some of these places, they were having weekly dinners, like maybe on a weeknight where people would come together. And this was a way that moms could and dads could not have to cook for their kids, that they could have someone else do the cooking. But I think it goes beyond that. It's also the opportunity to sit down at a table with your kids and talk to people that you might not know very well, get to know new people, learn a little bit from someone who's maybe a bit different from you. And in the book, we talk about some other ideas that are maybe a little harder to implement, but could start small. For example, a lot of schools and churches have big kitchens that are going unused a lot of the day. So could those be repurposed to make meals that people could heat up at the end of the day? And I just saw today that there's a school in Indiana that's doing some of that. So places are doing it, but it's not very widespread right now. And if you have money, there's options that can kind of help people get a healthy dinner on the table, but those are unaffordable. So we want to kind of think through how we can make some of those options affordable to more people.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jennifer is with us in La Crosse. Jennifer, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Jennifer?
Yeah, so just kind of hearing a little bit about this. My boyfriend and I were in our mid to late 30s, and he unfortunately had to undergo a heart stent. And with that, you know, there's the low sodium diet, or not diet, but more of a lifestyle change. So trying to meet the needs for him and his healthier eating, it's kind of a challenge, budget-wise, trying to make sure that I meet all the needs that he needs, along with myself, and then finding the time to cook these meals every day for him and myself gets to be a lot. It does. One thing we found that I found helpful with my mother, she has a garden, and there's times where once a week we will take turns cooking a larger meal, and then we portion off enough for my boyfriend and I, and then I'll send my parents home with a meal for two.
Jennifer, thank you so much for sharing your story. Well, that makes me think of a lot of things I saw in your book. Jocelyn, one of those is cooking for someone with special health needs. At least one of the families, I think one of the children, had diabetes. That just adds a whole new difficulty, and maybe, as Jennifer was saying, expense, if you have to have that in mind.
Yeah, this was a really prominent issue for many of the families that we spoke with. So you may have, like Jennifer's case, you may have a partner who has a health issue. You may have a child with a health issue. One of the mothers in our study, and who is in the book, she has a child who's on ADHD medication, and this suppresses the child's appetite. So she's trying to get the kid to eat, and maybe he doesn't want to eat. So as Jennifer notes, there's a lot of negotiating that goes on when we feed our families, and there's a lot of time and thought that has to be put into it, especially if somebody has sort of a complicated diet or needs to eat in a very specific way. This makes the work of feeding really complicated, and sometimes it can take the joy out of it as well when you have a lot of restrictions and you have to be very careful about this. I know my mother-in-law was diagnosed with adult onset of diabetes several years ago, and I have seen firsthand how everything has changed, and food has sort of become the center for them in the sense that she has to be so careful and measure out different foods, and this has really made feeding complex. Also, a lot of the families we got to know, they just struggled with things like kids who are picky eaters, and they spend time making these meals, and then the kids don't want to eat it, and it sort of becomes a battle. So this is the sort of stuff that doesn't get talked about when individual families are encouraged to just work harder, shop smarter, and put a great meal on the table.
And Sarah, Jennifer also mentioned, you know, working together in this case with her parents to kind of team up. Did you see a lot of that kind of solution where people reach outside of the family and try to work together, whether it's another family member, a neighbor, or whatever?
We did. We saw, it really varied. Some of the people in our study lived close to lots of friends and family, and some people didn't, which I think we see in the United States more broadly. But we did see lots of people sharing with neighbors. We had people like Jennifer mentioned, who a lot of people in rural areas especially, who were able to get fresh produce during the summer, who people who would cook for others or have other people cook for them to help them out. For some of the poor families in our study, that could be a really important survival strategy of people helping others when there were food shortages. And we also saw that sometimes it was a source of stress, especially for the families that were, you know, coming really close to running out of food at the end of the month, where people said that even if the kids just have friends over, that was a source of stress because they would then have to provide extra snacks or things like that. So we saw so many people working together, working really hard to try to get by, but also that even at the community level, just people needed a little bit more support.
Jocelyn, in our last minute or so, the issues you're talking about, do you think they're flying under the radar in the national discussion? Obviously, they're front and center for the people you talk to, but are we just overlooking these realities?
I think at the national level, people really care about food. I think we hear people talking about food, and sometimes those conversations go in frustrating directions, like should we be cutting the amount we allocate to food stamps? And so I think people care. They care about the environmental footprint and what's going on with, large industrial production of food. I think what is often overlooked is that day-to-day labor that people undertake to feed their families. And so individual advice is really alluring, you know, to tell people, like, chop vegetables in bulk on the weekend or make several meals on a Sunday so that you have these healthy meals that you can eat throughout the week. And on the face of things, those sort of solutions, they sound simple and they sound doable. But what we saw is that when people tried to put these solutions into practice in their everyday lives, it always fell apart because there's so many challenges coming at modern families from all sorts of different directions. So the big takeaway from our book is families are already trying really hard, and still they're falling short. So we know that we have a bigger problem on our hands.
We'll leave it there. Jocelyn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
And Sarah, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Sarah Bowen is Associate Professor of Sociology at North Carolina State University. Jocelyn Brenton is an Assistant Professor of Sociology at Ithaca College. Their new book is Pressure Cooker: Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems and What We Can Do About It. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a historian looks at the ideas that shaped the United States from pre-colonial times to the modern day. We'll hear about a new proposal to make Puerto Rico the 51st state in the nation, and we'll look at the latest research on birth control medications for men and whether there's a market for them. All that, plus a look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.